Hey there, Josh. How you doing?
Glenn, I'm doing well. How are you doing today?
I'm excellent. It's a great day here in Providence, Rhode Island. Autumn,
yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. We sort of have those in San Francisco. I'm looking out at my backyard. It's pretty nice out in the backyard. Maybe a little warm today like it was yesterday. But
I like Northern California, Josh. I would trade it for New England in a heartbeat.
Well, we could try to work that trade for you.
Actually,
if you're offering your
this
services,
this has nothing to do with Blogging Heads TV. But I have a leave next year. I'm thinking about applying at the Institute for Advanced Studying Behavioral Sciences out there. So put in a good word for me.
I saw the head.
Oh, you don't have a contact there? Oh my God!
No, I saw the head of it just yesterday walking around campus.
You mean I'm going to have to be judged on my merit?
And despite that, I think you'll do you'll do okay. It would be great. No, if you're serious, it would be great to have you out here. We don't have to.
Oh,
have
I'm very, very
discussion.
Serious about that. I do have a semester's leave. You know, I'm going to take the year off, try to get some funding somewhere, and you know, I have to talk my wife into this being a good idea, but I think she might be persuadable.
Well, I can tell you, there are worse places. There are worse places to spend your time. We got a big agenda for our conversation.
Politics, presidency, tectonic plates moving in American political culture.
They absolutely are. The first thing I'm going to do, though, is because I don't know how much we're going to get to in the conversation, I want to make sure that I hold up for the camera race, incarceration, and American values.
Bless you.
There you are, Glenn Lowry. This is your Tanner.
And company. Very good company indeed.
And very good company. Loic Wacan, Pam Carlin, and Tommy Shelby in the book with you. This is Boston Review, MIT Press, just came out.
Hot off the presses.
And I'm going to hold it up again. It's got a very nice cover. With that American,
you must have had a hand in that.
No, I leave.
Oh, that was the press.
I leave the cover. You know, MIT Press, I have to say, among its other virtues, is that they have terrifically good design values in the books, and these are very good. But we'll get back to that. You know,
okay, good.
I think a lot of us are going to have to go into some kind of treatment program after November 4th, because I don't know about you, but I'm spending more time than I should. Following this crazy election, and it's been going on for a long time.
Come on,
now.
It's completely consuming. This is the great political event of our lifetime.
It is the great.
We're so fortunate to be around. It seems to me. When all this is going on, I mean,
it's hard to keep in mind the fact that we should feel fortunate to be living through a state of global collapse. But I guess that does make it interesting. And the election certainly is. I don't know about you, but I probably check Matt Drudge about 8 times a day, Fox News online about 10 times a day. I never check Huffington Post without checking Fox News because I think I need
so you're
fair and balanced.
You look at the other side. Is that it?
I do try to look at the other side, and then I go to 538 to check on the true story on the polls. But you know, this is taking a lot of my time. But here's the
it takes a lot of time. Yeah, if you watch television, it gets even worse.
I don't watch any television except I did watch the debates. But here's the thing. I mean, we're all preoccupied about the horse race aspects of the campaign, who said what yesterday and today, and what does the latest poll look like. But so here's a perspective on the election. Essentially what's happening is that we're discovering that the laws of political gravity haven't been repealed. What you have is a candidate running from, although maybe trying to run away from, but candidate running from the party of an incredibly unpopular incumbent, running at a time of economic disaster, 2 wars going on, one of which there's some contest about whether or about how well it's going, the other of which there's no contest that it's going badly. So you got Obama running, having been dealt a very, very good hand going into the election.
Yes.
McCain having been dealt a very, very bad hand before any horse
Correct.
Race, before any choices, before any ads. From day one, one dealt a very good hand, one dealt a very bad hand. And so, you know, there's a lot of, noise and clamor.
Just-
but But you know, basically, what's happening is the predictable consequence of the basic structure of elections.
Are you setting that up, that thesis, as one side of an opposition?
Yeah, the opposition is that McCain has run a really terrible race, and Obama has run a really fantastic race. Now, the fact is, I think Obama has run a pretty good race, but I think McCain hasn't run a great race. But the deal is, McCain has been walking on a knife edge. He doesn't have much room to play. That's what it means to be dealt a bad hand. Anything you do that doesn't quite make sense looks really, really bad and seems very, very damaging. But that's because you got a bad hand.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Yeah. Is this question, the question of whether or not the events have merely conspired against McCain or that he has been incompetent in a situation, is it important? The question, given that he's going to lose, and, one says that baldly, and that's, you stick your neck out or whatever, but, all indications are. And that, therefore, everything that's interesting is about what then. Not, somehow it doesn't even matter why McCain lost this race. But, I mean, okay.
I think we shouldn't get distracted.
Question, briefly, to say, I think Obama has been dealt an incredibly, amazingly fortuitous hand.
Yes.
And not only with the financial collapse coming just as the momentum in the race was starting to change, and with the disaster of the Bush administration, the 8-year albatross, which McCain can't help but get hung around his neck, even though you might argue objectively there's a case that, he's a long way from being George W. Bush, and if he had prevailed in 2000, our country would have been much the better for it. But, again, that case is not very interesting either. And also, this thing about the historical saliency and power of the Obama narrative, that it's something people want to believe in. And, I won't reduce that to a biased press, although I think the bias is is very clear. But, again, I don't think that's a particularly interesting question. I think the general thing about how elites from many different segments of American society come into a kind of understanding about, where we are and what's important and all of this, and then agree upon something. So for example, just to be concrete, and then I'll stop talking, the construction of Obama's competency.
Yeah.
The achievement of it being credibly and widely held that he is up to the job. Now, this is not whether or not he's up to the job. This is how we come to understand him to be up to the job. He started out with us not understanding him so, and we've come to understand him. And how that has been accomplished is deeply interesting to me.
Right.
And
so
it's,
I think
it's one of those things that, McCain tried to pick at it one way or another, but he never found a solid basis from which to try to, weigh in against the sort of consensus view about this that had come to be.
I think there are three points there that I want to make about the construction of Obama's competence. First of all, you have to agree that an important part in the construction of the political construction of Obama's competence is that he repeatedly has demonstrated under a lot of pressure, ranging from the pressure of the Democratic debates to the pressure of the debate with McCain, to, I thought, for example, a very good performance in the interviews that he did with Bill O'Reilly. And I should say, a very good performance by Bill O'Reilly's judgment.
Yeah, I agree. Those were very interesting interviews.
Very interesting, and I think he successfully demonstrated to O'Reilly, as O'Reilly said, that this is a serious guy with real convictions. O'Reilly doesn't agree with him, but I've heard O'Reilly defend Obama in a pretty heated argument with Laura Ingraham, where she thought, this guy's a fraud. And O'Reilly said, no. I disagree with him. He's a redistributionist, as O'Reilly said. So I think part of the reason that Obama has been able to, that the case has been made for Obama's competence is that he's repeatedly demonstrated
I can't hear you now, Josh.
Obama has repeatedly demonstrated real common competence. Can you hear me now?
Okay, let's move on to something else.
Well, let me second point on that. The last time we talked, the analogy that you gave for McCain's choice of Palin was that this was a kind of poison pawn chess maneuver that the Obama people into challenging Palin's competence, yes, so that then they could turn around and say, who are you to be making this claim? I think it was exactly the opposite.
Right.
I think, you know, with all due respect, love and affection, I think you got it exactly wrong. I don't think it was a poison pawn. I think this was, as some people said, a Hail Mary pass. If you put it in a chess analogy, this was like sacrificing a bishop early in the game.
Yeah.
Because what McCain did by choosing Palin was to give away what continues to be his strongest argument, which is the competence argument. So it's made it very hard in the construction of Obama's competence. It's been very tough for McCain to challenge that competence because he's got somebody of, I think, unarguably weak competence to do the job. But there's another lawyer. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, let me respond because I see where you're going. You're right. I was wrong. I was wrong about how that was going to work out, and it was a mistake in retrospect. And
no, you have to apologize, Glenn. This is American culture now. You have to, if you get something wrong, you have to publicly. I'm kidding. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I'm not infallible. I can be wrong about stuff. I was wrong about that.
Yeah.
Now, what I just want to say something, which is, it was not a poison pun, which is a kind of risky but nevertheless perhaps worthwhile sacrifice where you lure somebody into something and then you get. This was a blunder where the guy's queen just, you know, rampages all over your pawn structure and you're left with nothing at the end of the day. I mean, he didn't get anything out of it. It didn't fly, I think, because many people, in a way across the political spectrum, it was, you know, a little bit like the Harriet Myers thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just came early to a judgment that she was, you know, so gratuitously unfit for the position that, as you say, it belied poor judgment and not putting your country first and desperation and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
On the other hand, and I had said that by turning the conversation to a discussion about who would be fit for a position, it would shed more light on Obama's alleged unfitness to be for the position. I was wrong about that.
Yeah.
But the establishment certainly helped a lot, and the reaction to those early interviews that Gibson and Katie Couric certainly didn't help a lot, and the sort of derision, the sort of resounding contempt with which this nomination was greeted by so many influential cultural figures, you know, the late night comics and all of that. Also, you know, the feminist reaction to the sort of mommy war issues that were implied by Palin's announcement. I mean, you know, her physical attractiveness. I mean, the very aspects of her person that one might, and I think may yet, find very appealing. Some people will continue to find very appealing.
Yeah.
Also turned in the minds of many people, I think, into you know, something negative, something that elicited. You know, I think about Sarah Palin a little bit like the Alger Hiss thing, although, I mean, obviously very, very different. But what I mean is, you know, a person about whom how you position yourself has all to do with where you stand on the deep argument of your time. In this case, the culture war argument, the argument between coastal elites and, you know, middle American, you know, putative authenticity, that argument. Which is not over. If you think that these Pentecostals and these born-agains and whatnot have been just pushed off to the margins of American politics, I think you better think again.
No, this is not 1927. It's not the Scopes trial, which puts them off the stage until Jimmy Carter ran for president. I don't think it's anything like that. But I do think that, you know, there are a couple of things about the Palin issue. One is, I don't think it was a good choice, but this to go back to that laws of gravity issue and the fact that McCain wasn't dealt a very good hand. If you think about what the alternatives were, and then play out the scenarios of his having picked one of the alternative possibilities, I think you come to the conclusion that the Sarah Palin choice wasn't really much worse than any of the other alternatives. And that's to say that he was locked in by a bad hand. So if he picks he picks Joe Lieberman, people are not going to be sitting around now celebrating the wisdom of the Joe Lieberman choice. They're going to be saying, "Good God!"
It would have torn his convention apart and so on. But I want to say this: Tim Pawlenty was mentioned, governor of Minnesota.
Yes,
this guy Jindal, not yet 40 years old, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, that's right.
Governor of Louisiana. Now, how much do you think they know about what the Russians are doing with respect to Georgia and
same deal. I think the guy had a bad hand. They came from nowhere.
They're not ready to be commander-in-chief and leader of the free world anymore than anybody else. And this is why I want to say this cultural thing is important.
Well,
I don't think that woman is stupid. And in fact,
the
notion that she's a twit, you know, this dismissive contempt for the fact that she goes to a church where they raise their hands up over their heads and dance around in circles when they're happy with Jesus.
Yeah.
This is ugly, Josh.
Yeah, I'm with you.
It's ugly, and it's sowing the seed for a backlash. I really think sober people on the left ought to denounce it.
Let me jump in on that, because I did say that when we talked about her right after the selection that I thought she was an extremely impressive person, that she was the kind of person who would hand you your head if you underestimated her. And I also said that I thought she was not at this point up to doing the job. Now, you know, Governor Schwarzenegger agrees that she's not today up to doing the job. He thinks she will be by January. I don't think that's been demonstrated. I'm not prepared to take a chance. But here's the deal. Number one, and I want to underscore what you're saying. Number one, the sexism directed against her has been disgusting, gross.
Yep.
And I want to give you one example of this, which is, you know, I mentioned before, you know, I kind of trade back and forth between looking at Drudge and Fox and looking at Huffington Post and Talking Points Memo. Huffington Post did have, and it was not up for long, maybe they took it down for good reason, but they had a clip, just the beginning clip before things got nasty, the beginning clip of this, Larry Flint, Nailin Palin. The Russian tank stops in front of her house, and the guys come into the place, and you can tell where things are going to go from there.
I didn't see this. This was a photo spread in one of these magazines.
It wasn't a photo spread. This was a video.
Oh Lord.
Yeah, that's right. And listen, you know, I didn't see this.
Is it still up?
I'm not recommending. I'm the least prudish guy, you know, so it's not about prudish. I just thought, though, this is, you know, it's disgusting that it was done, and I think it was really awful that Huffington Post put it up. And frankly, I also think the same story on this, on the $150,000 clothing bill. This is one of these things where if the Democrats had discovered that their candidate had spent
they're piling on, it's a cheap shot. So they decided to dress her well because they were displaying her on television. I mean, so what?
Well, Campbell Brown nailed the point. She said, you know, let's face the facts. The reality is that women are judged on their appearances in a way that men aren't. So you're going to have it both ways.
Then you're going to judge them for trying to look well, and you're going to judge them if they don't look well.
So I think that's really disgusting. The other thing I think is this, elitism business. I completely agree with you that there is a disparaging attitude. The Times, I know, is supposed to be all completely in Obama's pocket, but there's a very nice, I think, a nice front page piece about Palin today. Well, she wouldn't be interviewed for the story by the Times.
I can't believe you now, Jeff.
Yeah, there's a nice front page piece in the Times today about Palin's history, which describes how, you know, what she's ended up doing by becoming governor and running for vice president is a complete surprise to everybody who knew her when she was, you know, 16, 18, 20 years old. And, you know, it's a nice piece, and I think it should be a cause for everybody to celebrate that somebody, you know, kind of, you know, discovered themselves over the course of growing up, to, you know, learned about their passions and about their competences, and is now doing something that, you know, really at age 16,
let me give you an analogy. I hear you.
I agree. It's terrific.
Let me give you an analogy. She's a person who's been picked from obscurity and thrust into something by the forces that she had nothing to do with.
Right.
And she's an estimable person in her own right, and person of whatever the qualities are that she has, which evidently are not trivial because she had already made some significant accomplishments.
Exactly.
And who's to know what she could become?
Yeah.
So that's all true. Now, suppose she'd been a welfare mother from the south side of Chicago, and I don't think you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
Well, suppose a liberal Democrat who was running in a situation where he thought that if he could mobilize, you know, some sector of the Democratic elected and get them out and get them registered, he might have a chance. And here was a woman who had worked her way off of welfare and gone to the community college and had gotten a law degree at night and had gotten to a state legislature somewhere or whatever and had, you know, whatever. And then he picks her out of obscurity to be the vice president. And she, too, maybe she talks the English language a little bit different from other people because she, you know, came up and was kind of an autodidact. And maybe, you know, she's not all that up on whatever, whatever, and it doesn't come off quite right. Okay? But nevertheless, there's something really deeply admirable there, and she also excites a tremendous following and admiration from a lot of people. Maybe she went to one of these storefront Holy Roller churches, too.
Yeah.
Now, you imagine the right-wing press decimating that woman, making fun of her religion, poking a camera around in the neighborhood where she grew up and finding out that her brother-in-law was a crack addict and putting that in the newspaper and doing everything else. Do you imagine that?
Yeah, or
that would, that would be one of the ugliest chapters in American political history, and that's not unlike what happened to Sarah Palin.
Yep, yep, and it would be ugly either way. But the thing is, Glenn, I mean, let's just put...
But it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened the other way because it's unacceptable to have that kind of racial stereotype. The McCain camp's effort to appeal to racial sentiments has been rejected as illegitimate by the American authority. But the snide sneering down their noses from Upper West Side of Manhattan and Hollywood at the rest of America as a bunch of hicks has not, I repeat, not been marginalized as beneath contempt.
I'm not sure I agree with you on half of that.
Well, at least that draws the argument sharply.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on half of that. I think, I think the attitudes that people display toward her are really repugnant, and they are of a piece with what was for me absolutely the low point of the Obama campaign, which I think has generally been an extremely good and admirable campaign, which were the San Francisco remarks.
Well, what about public financing, Josh? What about changing the entire equation of money in politics in America? What about making legitimate that you can buy the presidency? Do you think that's a small or large moral issue? And how would you judge the Obama campaign on that question?
Let's come to that in just a minute. I just want to say about the film issue that while we're engaged in the kind of cultural, you know, there's a cultural studies analysis that we can do. I agree with you about the reprehensible character of the contempt shown for her. I don't agree with you that the ex-welfare mom from the south side of Chicago wouldn't be subject to a comparably disgusting set of attacks. But let's also step back. There are three things. When you've gotten past the sexism and when you've gotten past the elitist contempt directed toward Sarah Palin, both incredibly objectionable, there are three things about her that you do have to keep in mind. First of all, her views are terrible. And that's what the focus should be on, her views about social issues, her views about foreign policy, and for that matter, her views about the economy. The views are terrible. Secondly, there is, you know, I agree with Colin Powell on this. There is no evidence that she is now, at this point, up to doing this job. I don't mean in the future. I mean now, ready to perform the job. And I don't agree with people who say it's the same for Barack Obama. I think that is, at this point in the game, ridiculous. But there's a
Josh,
third
I
thing
agree
about
with
her.
That. Why are we rehearsing these arguments?
There's a third thing about her, which, well, because I think, it, you know, that the reason we're rehearsing the arguments is because it's all well and good to focus on and condemn the contempt shown towards her, but then we also have to treat her seriously, Glenn, not as an object of fun and contempt, but as a candidate for the vice president, is to evaluate the qualifications she has. And I say terrible. And thirdly, she has a contempt problem of her own. And it came out in that comment she made a month or so ago when people said, how come you didn't get your passport until last year? And she said, well, unlike, you know, kids from, you know, rich families, I went to work when I graduated from college, And I've been working every day since then. And I thought that she was showing both ignorance and contempt about how lots of us live. And I'll make it personal. When I graduated from... there is contempt on both sides.
I don't get it. I don't get it. She is the vice presidential candidate of a losing ticket on the eve of an election that's going to change our politics, and you still want to make the argument about why she shouldn't be the vice president of the United States. I concede the argument. She shouldn't be the vice president of the United States. But what McCain did in that Hail Mary pass was pick somebody from obscurity who had views as such as she had and had a resume such as she had to be the vice president. He threw the pass. It wasn't caught. End of story. Next case. So, I mean, when I say that the exposed substructure of power and cultural consensus in the country has been exposed by this thing, that's something that I think is really worth talking about because it's something that's going to have consequences. So, for example, the people who support Barack Obama in the inner city of Cleveland, okay, where are the long reports on network television about the fever swamps of the inner city of Cleveland where they support Barack Obama for reasons that neither one of us would credit? We don't see them. We don't see them. The kind of thing that's being established here. Now, I, in a way, I am overjoyed that the right-wing ploy of creating these quasi-racist and nearly anti-Semitic kind of tropes in our politics and then flaunting them around and getting the people of Middle America all excited in the red states and grasping and retaining power. I'm delighted that it's being repudiated by history, which is what happens right now. So I want to be very clear about that. Okay? But I'm just saying that the people who are deciding this and how this is being decided shows me something about power in America. And while, you know, I'm kind of on the good side of it as it's being exercised this time, I don't know about those snobs who are, you know, especially on the religious question. I wish the contempt that has been shown for certain kinds of faith that has been
Glenn, you're trying to have openly. I don't understand the position you're taking. I'm going to push back because you're trying to have
because I don't want to talk about Sarah Palin. I want to talk about American politics.
You're trying to have it both ways. One hand, you're saying, look, the election is done. Why are you making the case about Sarah Palin's not being qualified? What I'm saying is and you say, let's talk about the contempt.
Can we talk about
the contempt held by the elites for Sarah Palin? And I'm saying, if you want to talk about the American political culture, I think there is contempt for her, but I think, and I'll just reiterate this point, she has a contempt problem of her own. But if we want to talk about the big issue about American politics, here's the deal. There was a project, it's a generation-long project. That project is in the process of being defeated. The project had three components. It was against regulation. Government is the problem, not the solution, as Ronald Reagan said. Alan Greenspan repudiated that the other day, the leading proponent of it. Neoconservative foreign policy, which is strongly unilateralist, treat the model of pushback against the Soviet Union as a model for dealing with every problem in the world, and don't try to coordinate on a whole bunch of global issues. Third, social conservatism at home, social conservative moralism. Each one of those three strong themes over the last generation, over the last 30 years, really, in American politics, each one separately is under challenge. And the conjunction of them, the project defined by the conjunction of socially conservative moralism, neoconservative foreign policy, and a deregulatory approach to the economy, is that the political coalition that came together on that is in a state of collapse. And when you look at the demography about what, you know, where the, you know, 20 to 35 year old voters are, there isn't much prospect of that project being resuscitated. That I think is the big story.
But I want to comment
behind the election.
May I comment?
You may. Yeah, so long as you say okay. the right thing.
So here's what I want to say. I agree with you. I it's a nice analysis. So you have the economic, the minimal state, the sort of libertarian. You have the freewheeling foreign policy, and you have guns, God, and gays.
Right.
And I agree that those things are back on their heels now, and I think that coalition is finished. I don't know what's coming.
Exactly.
But I'm with you. And that's where I want to go. Yeah. I want to say, I see no coherent counter philosophy with respect to the role of the state, organization of the economy, and whatnot. I mean, Larry Summers is a great man.
Yeah.
He's a significant economist. Yeah. He's a whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't know what that really adds up to. For example, with respect to regulation, I think deregulation was actually largely a success. I don't mean the specific financial deregulations that might have been implicated in this instability.
Yeah.
But I mean the general philosophy of not letting the government set the price of natural gas at the wellhead or decide, you know, what rates trucking companies could charge to move goods across state lines and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I think the rapid change of technology has made competitive antitrust regulations obsolete in many cases because the issue of whether or not a firm has X or Y percent of the market has been trumped by the issue about in 16, 18 months there's going to be a whole new product and everybody else is going to have switched over to something different. And I could go on with many, many examples. I think free trade is the right idea.
Yeah.
It's the right idea.
Yeah.
For the world,
yep.
not just for the United States of America.
Yep.
This is a deeply philosophically resonant point for me about open borders and allowing goods to move. And that's where our prosperity comes from. These ideas are correct.
Right.
So the notion that George W. Bush was a horrible president doesn't refute the insights of Milton Friedman, such as they were. They don't exhaust all economic insights, but they are insights.
Yeah, but Larry
and
Summers,
I can go on with that. With respect to foreign policy, what I've heard from Obama is, I'll fight to the death in Pakistan.
Yeah.
That's not a refutation of American adventurism around the world.
Yeah.
I don't know, is Joseph Nye going to be the person, are we going to be talking about soft power and all that kind of stuff? I don't regard those, with due respect to Professor Nye, as deeply resonant reflections on the nature of global politics.
Yeah.
So I have no idea where I'm being led in the Middle East, and we could go on.
Yeah.
What's the vision there?
I don't know. I agree with you. I think there has been some, I think it's probably not completely unlike the situation in 1932 when Roosevelt was elected. When, if you ask people in the 32 election what the governing vision was that was emerging, there really wasn't one. I think it's easier to say on the third point, the rejection of socially conservative moralism, and I think that really
I agree with you. I agree with your demographic point that the young people are in a completely different place.
And then
they're in a different place on race. They're in a different place on sex.
Yeah, that's right.
I agree with you.
Okay, but on the issue about basically, if there's a governing philosophy that's suggested, and this is I'm agreeing with you that there really isn't one when I say this. It's a kind of, more pragmatic approach toward deregulation and re-regulation. I mean, when Waxman asked the question to Greenspan, he said, so are you saying that your ideology led you to be excessively opposed to regulation? And Greenspan basically said, yes. That he wasn't making a judgment on the merits. He just had this blind faith and trust that you didn't have to worry about the guys doing the credit default swaps requiring regulation. So there's a loose pragmatism on the regulatory side. I think
let me just say this, Josh.
Yeah.
Because our time is limited. Yeah. I just read Merton Miller's Nobel lecture. Merton Miller is the finance economist who got the Nobel Prize for some of his work. His Nobel lecture is a defense of the proposition that you should not regulate because high leverage is not a problem.
Yeah.
He was talking about the leverage buyouts of the 1980s, all these corporate conglomerate mergers and these takeovers and all these deals where, the Ivanboskis and all that. It's ancient history now. But at the time that he got the Nobel Prize, that was in the news, and so that's what he was talking about. But when you read it in the context of today's financial crisis, he must be embarrassed by this lecture, I would think.
Yeah.
Because he's saying, don't worry, no problem. The market will take care of it.
Yeah. Well,
okay.
Yeah.
So now that turns out not to be the case.
Right. That's right.
Let me not try to, rebut a Nobel lecturer right here, but basically because of the possibility of bubbles and the fact that this leverage has made the thing much more susceptible to these unstable crisis situations, which then require government action,
right,
in order to be corrected. And I think that's what.
So on the ideological side,
but I want to just limit the point. I mean, it's not as if he's rejecting the whole philosophy.
Absolutely. So I say a more pragmatic attitude rather than an ideological attitude, and that's what Greenspan had, was an ideological attitude, and that's essentially what he said in response to Waxman. This was a total shock to him. Well, it could only come as a total shock to you if you just weren't paying attention to any of the counter arguments because you had a kind of ideological faith, but that's not a very strong statement of a governing philosophy to say I'm going to be pragmatic and do it when it's a good thing and not do it when it's not a good thing. But the big problem, I think, and this is where what's the alternative at the foreign policy level to neoconservative strong unilateralism? You got problems about global warming and not just carbon issues, but a whole bunch of other resource constraints on food, on energy, on water. You got a global financial and economic collapse. You do have this toxic mix of collapsed states, Afghanistan being the principal example, and non-state terror located in those places, and also a destitution, 20% of the world's population, and those are the people who are going to be hardest pressed by all of the above. And I think when it comes to defining the governing philosophy for this next generation of problems, the issue about social conservative moralism is not really where the action is. And I think in terms of the domestic economy, issues about having a more pragmatic attitude toward market regulation are not where the action is. The real big action is what you do on the fact that these are all, that the biggest problems that we face, from loose nukes to global warming to financial collapse, are all, as well as the problem of terrorism, are all essentially global problems requiring global coordination for a solution. The McCain view that what you do is set up a league of democracies is totally hopeless and beside the point. But what you do, I think, is a great open question, and I'm completely with you in thinking that the Obama has some promise to say something about that. People around the world like him, but I don't know what the answer is. It's the great open question that we've got. I just think there's much more promise on his side.
Let me just address one piece of this thing, which is the implications for, because I've started to see these articles appear now. I think Nick Kristof had one in the New York Times this morning, maybe, and I've seen others. Rebranding. I mean, all this superficial rebranding America. Now, don't get me wrong. I think electing Obama certainly has got to make people look differently at the country.
Yeah.
And there's great excitement outside of our borders about the remarkable phenomenon of a second-generation African-American person being elected president of the United States. So that it does say something. And, of course, it does say something about our country. I mean, that shouldn't be
no small thing
left casually to the side. It does say something. But here's what I want to say. What's the deep structure of the oppositions that create conflict in the global political community, which causes the United States to be at war, to have a massive military institution, and to conduct itself in world affairs with the implicit threat of the use of violence? What is that about? Now, that's partly about us, and it's partly about the world. Right? And how much of that has changed by the election of Obama as president? How much can any president change about those things? I don't know the answer to these questions.
Not much, but here's the thing. The thing that worries me most about this, I hope, emerging Obama presidency is what I worry about is that, in 10 years, you'll have some books which bear the title the tragedy of the Obama presidency, the U.S. in Afghanistan.
It'll be his Vietnam, is that's what they're saying, right?
Absolutely. There was a very good piece by Russ Feingold, one of the few good pieces by a politician.
Again, you guys speaking to the mic.
Sorry. A very good piece by Russ Feingold, Senator Feingold.
Yes.
One of the few good pieces on the Afghanistan issue by an American politician, which basically said, look, this place is a disaster. There's no question about that. And don't hold your breath that the less extreme Taliban are going to make an agreement in Mecca with the Pashtun leadership of the country and everything is going to be fine. This isn't going to be what happens in Afghanistan. But that there isn't anybody who knows the country and knows it seriously who thinks that taking a couple of divisions out of Iraq and moving them into Afghanistan is going to do much good to turn things around in Afghanistan. It's just it's not where I don't have a solution. You know, if I had a solution to the problem, I'd win a Nobel Peace Prize. But that knee-jerk reaction on Obama's side on the Afghanistan issue to have something to run against.
Here's what I have to say about that. I hope that we don't have a clue. I say I hope.
Yeah.
We don't have a clue what President Obama will actually do about these matters.
Yes.
I hope that nothing in the campaign is an informative indicator of what he will do.
Yeah.
I hope that if he is elected and inaugurated President of the United States and inherits the awesome and amazing responsibility, that he will sit de novo and, from scratch, as it were.
Yep.
Reconfigure the whole situation, and I'm talking now about the global war on terror. I'm not saying he will repudiate it or simply not do it. Maybe that's what he'll do. Maybe he'll do something else. But I'm hoping that he would bring all these qualities that we have evidence now to believe that he possesses, and the courage and the vision and the moral wisdom to decide about the matters of this kind.
Yeah.
And I hope that that does not then issue in a bogged down, interminable, unwinnable military conflict someplace that stirs up more hornets than it kills in the nest, that bedevils us for a generation. I just hope that he is up to doing that.
Sounds like you're recommending flip-flopping, Glenn, and I'm
I'm recommending flip-flopping in a big way.
I'm 100% with you. I think you just nailed the point. I mean, he has got to say, okay, I said a bunch of stuff. People elected me for my capacity to think and to bring together people, and now I'm going to think and bring together people. And you know the the Afghanistan issue for me, and Pakistan as well, but the Afghanistan issue in particular, the idea of moving forces into Afghanistan, I think is really
I said before, Josh, are we going to embark on a 100 years war against Islam, against radical Islam? Are we, the West, leaders of the West, about to embark on a 100 years war? Is that where we're going? Is that what 9/11 is leading us toward? And do we want to go there? Is that the only option, really?
Yeah.
I don't believe that's the only option.
We both know what has to be done from day one, and what will take from day one until day, 1,460. I'm trying to multiply 4 times 365, and maybe really 8 times 365, which is to try to do something on getting two states to address the Israel-Palestine situation. Because until you do something about that, if you look at, what is the things have gone well in the world for Iran over the last 8 years, basically, other than oil prices coming down. And the essential reason is that they have taken a very strongly militant approach on that issue. And until something is done to address that issue, you want to have a game changer in that region. That's the only game changer there is. And, maybe Obama has the capacity to do something about that. I don't know. But if he doesn't do something about that, then I think lots of the kinds of conflicts that we're facing are going to, look exactly the same after 8 years as they look now, except for one thing, they'll look worse. But let's come to an issue domestically. You just wrote
Hold on, Josh. I got something else I'm going to say just very briefly.
Yeah.
It's about Colin Powell, and it's about Barack Obama as Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
The Colin Powell point is, okay, so Powell came out and endorsed Obama, and he, in effect, broke from the Republican Party in the way that he endorsed Obama. And I only wish that he had had the courage to break from the Republican Party when it might have made a difference. Okay, so I said my piece on that. About Obama as Mandela, what I want to say is he's going to be several years younger than I am right now if he serves two terms as president of the United States, which is to say Barack Obama could be a great world leader for the first half of the 21st century. So what's at stake here, it may be hard to see on the eve of an election, is not just electing a president of the United States. It's really altering world leadership going forward for decades.
I think that's I think it's a very good point, and I think I want to make one point about, you know, I talked before about the gravitational forces in the campaign as opposed to seeing it as a horse race. There's one point where I think Obama made a very critical choice in the way that he conducted the campaign, and it was a choice that he was making in opposition to a lot of pressure. So remember, it's hard to remember back this far now, but coming out of the Republican convention, the race was tightening. There was a lot of noise coming out of the Republican Party. There was a bunch of excitement about Sarah Palin, and people were starting to talk again about Obama, and he's too soft, and you know, we should have gone with Hillary Clinton, and where's where's the passion and where's the anger? And we didn't get it. And I think in retrospect, it was an extremely wise choice on Obama's part for two reasons. One, you know, people have said this, and I'm sure there's some truth to this, which is that the last as the angry black guy. But I think there's another aspect of it, which is that that's not who Obama is. That's not he have to be a fake to be getting up and pretending that he was a sort of angry, tough guy. He did it a little bit in his acceptance speech, and I didn't really particularly like it very much. Maybe some other people did. But I think he made a decision. I don't know. Maybe this is wrong, but this is my sense about it. He made a decision that he was going to run as who he is. And I think it was a wise decision in terms of winning the election, and also a wise decision in terms of governance.
All this lionizing of Obama, it doesn't much excite me. But okay, I just have this to say. Without the financial crisis, we might be looking back on that decision and saying, what a blunder. If the McCain momentum actually builds and the characterological questions about Obama start to move to the center forward, you might be saying, why didn't he fight harder or whatever?
Two points on that.
I mean, this is all mythology making as far as I'm concerned. I don't know that – we'll see. We'll see what kind of qualities, and I certainly hope that they are exemplary, demonstrates as president. I don't think we know very much about that right now. In anticipation of his landslide, of his landslide victory, narratives begin to move as people, I don't even think wittingly, sort of alter their psychological posture in order to make it, you know, compatible with the zeitgeist. So, you know, I read these columns in part when I think, you know, this is careerism. People are writing columns because they want to have access to the next president of the United States. And I think intellectuals do it too.
Yeah.
We alter our conceptual apparatus in order to make it, things would have worked
well,
out.
believe me, Glenn, I won't accuse you of doing that when you suggested an analogy with Nelson Mandela and his I really wouldn't accuse you of that. But the thing is,
sorry, Josh.
No, that's okay. Don't confuse what I'll tendentiously describe as sensible praise for Obama with lionizing him. The guy is a talent. I mean, he is not a knucklehead. You can't say, Sarah Palin, stop being so elitist and looking down your nose at her and recognize her talent, and not say, gee, Barack Obama, the guy's got some skills. I mean, he for sure has some skills. And if you recognize those skills...
I don't deny that.
Okay, so I'm not lionizing him when I say he made a good decision when he said, I'm not going to get up and pretend that I am somebody other than who I am. And the thing is, you're right. It might be that had the financial crisis not come along, that we'd be looking back now and saying, shit, he really screwed up. But, you know, the guy has partly run a campaign as somebody who wants not only to win but to govern, and you can't govern as a fraud. And I think he has kept this kind of, you know, that's, you know, this is what people say about him who know him, that that is what he's like. He's a compulsive triangulator. He's a compulsive listener. It's
more
a
power to him.
You know, and more,
you know,
power,
Josh,
to
we've all got a tremendous stake in his success, you know. I mean, yeah. So
we do.
I stand corrected. You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, and I know if my some of my dear relatives were watching this, they would say that says more about Glenn Lowry than it does about Barack Obama. Because I've heard that both from my progeny and from my,
yeah, you know,
my
Glenn,
dear
Glenn,
spouse.
You do. I've been on the other side of this in conversations with you, but you're very critical of other people. Up other people's praising of Obama because you're worried, and understandably, that they've been drinking the Kool-Aid, that they're lionizing him, that they're not praising him in the right way. But there's nothing like people criticizing Obama to bring out the your own political and, I think, you know, genuine human affection for what he is and what he stands for and what he's done. Which brings me to the
thank
issue.
You.
Yeah, no, I mean that. Yeah. I think it, but I think getting the, and I'm trying to model myself on you here, Glenn, because I think getting the balance right, praising, but always resisting lionizing. And remembering that, you know, the responsibility of intellectuals is not to suck up to power, but to speak
please,
truth.
Please, don't forget that.
Absolutely. Boy, oh boy. Let's talk about race for a minute.
Okay.
Because you just wrote a piece. It's really a wonderful piece in,
Thank you.
Really think a wonderful piece in Boston Review, about race and about identity, more generally. And one of the things that you say, the race identity part of the piece is to emphasize that you know, racial identity is not a matter of fate; it's a matter of choice. It's decisions that people make about how prominent to make their race and their decisions about what they do and its largest in their life. And it's easy to forget that it's a matter of choice and not a fate. But you, one of the things that you said early on in the piece is that you think particularly, you're reflecting on the election, and you say that particularly in this election, with the prominence that identity issues have played in the election, that
right.
we really have to worry about making too much out of identity. And why do you say more about that?
Okay, well, first of all, I want to be clear that I'm not begrudging African-Americans being enthusiastic about supporting Barack Obama, who's an African-American, if that's what they want to do, which is
yeah.
what they want to do, with more power to them, and great. And I
yeah.
am, too, for that matter,
yeah.
at some level. But the idea that, you know, so I say, in the essay, I say, identity versus authenticity. I try to create an opposition.
Right.
And I say, we all belong to some tribe or another to which we mm-hmm. feel some loyalty and from which we draw, you know, resources for our lives, but on the other hand, we're also individual persons, and as individual persons, human beings, there's some sort of existential dilemmas that we can't avoid.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the furniture of our lives, the things that we are given, like, you know, our ethnicity or race or cultural mm-hmm. heritage or sexual orientation or gender or whatever it might be. These are not nationality, you know, language, you know, these are not unimportant. No one would say that, you know, they don't matter. I don't say that they have no place. But they mustn't trump this act of self-authorship that each of us is you know, challenged by, of making something of our lives. I say that, you know, they're like the setting on
yeah.
the stage. We yet have to provide a script for, you know, the play that is our lives, this kind of metaphor. And that sometimes leads us to, you know, puts us in a situation where, you know, we can't, you know, the groupthink, the kind of reflexive embrace of what seems to be kind of the line or whatever is something that we ought to, you know, we ought to challenge. And of course I could see it in this election. I mean, you know, I've said African Americans can go ahead and vote for Barack Obama yeah. because he's black. That's okay by me. You know, please, let's not get too deeply mired in that, because, you know, first of all, let's not miss the significance of what's happening here, which is way more than the fact that this guy
yeah.
is black. And secondly, we don't want a politics where people are appealing to vote for people on that basis, which is why the reaction against that, or the counter to that, that the McCain-Palin campaign has come up with, and that the Hillary Clinton campaign came up with before that, mm-hmm. of really making, trying to make politically salient whiteness,
yeah.
or a certain variety of whiteness, that word's in, you know, inverted commas,
yeah.
As a counterpoint to, quote, blackness, was, you know, so deeply troubling. I mean, this is not a good thing. John Lewis, the congressman from Atlanta, Georgia, was criticized, I think rightly, for having said, accusing John McCain, comparing him to George Wallace, and criticizing the McCain campaign for its racial move. And I think, you know, Lewis's remarks were intemperate. But I think, you know, saying that well in American political culture ought not be drawn from.
Yeah.
Don't go there.
Yes.
Don't
yes.
waken that monster. I think yeah. this is a correct thing
yeah.
to say.
Right.
Now we're getting ready to have an election where we're going to see long, and we've already seen long lines of almost all African American people lining up outside of urban polling places mm-hmm. to cast their ballots 98-1
yeah.
For Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And they're going to prevail in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio, it would appear, and Virginia, and maybe even Georgia, it would appear, over a large number of more or less explicitly mobilized whites to try to keep this from happening to our country, quote unquote. This is fire
yeah,
that we're
is.
Playing with here. And I, you know, so my essay is to try to sort of hold out some kind of beacon for a transcendent, which I think Barack Obama agrees. I mean,
yeah,
I think that's
right.
what his philosophy yeah. points towards, and I think, as he has yeah. pointed out, that's what his very mixed-race person
yeah.
points toward.
You know,
so,
there was a
you know,
study that I saw,
that.
Saw recently from some colleagues who do public opinion, and so they had done some internet surveys, and so they asked people, both pro-Obama voters and pro-Clinton voters, do you think that Obama's race is a reason for the Obama voters is a reason for voting for him, and then for the McCain voters, do you think that Obama's race is a reason for voting against him? And they had two ways of running the survey. One was they would just ask people, do you think it is? And the other, I won't go into the details of it, but they had a way in which you could, in effect, answer the question anonymously. But they could figure out whether or not you thought that the race was a reason for voting for him or reason for voting against him.
Hmm.
The good news was that there were very few McCain supporters who said race is a reason for voting against him, whether openly or in this anonymous experimental setup. There were a few more, but not very many. But when you asked African-American Obama supporters, do you think Obama's race is a reason voting for him, 25% openly said yes. But when you had a way of doing it anonymously, 75% said that his race was – it was just our reason, not the only reason, but it
sure.
was our reason for voting for him. But I think it's right to say that this is – you know, we I think we talked about this before when he was you know, giving his speeches in Philadelphia around the Jeremiah Wright issue in that period. He would describe Michelle as an African-American woman, but he wouldn't refer to himself as an African-American man. So he's, I think, really played that down. And there was an interesting moment. I don't know if you watched the Alfred E. Smith dinner, the comic acts by Obama.
I saw
yeah.
Outtakes from it.
Yeah. I mean, the fact is, McCain is a much better stand-up comic than Obama. McCain was really good, surprisingly, but he was very
I was
good.
Struck by the visuals at that dinner. There they were in white tie.
Yeah.
And Obama, and, you know, he's beautiful. I mean, I must say that. I know that's going to sound
yeah.
weird.
Yeah, no, it doesn't.
But he's very nice to look at.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He has this long face. He has this winning smile.
Yeah.
And I was just struck by the visuals of it.
Yeah, it
I agree with you. McCain was really quite good.
McCain was quite good. The thing that
you
was
know,
interesting,
he was, you know, it yeah. gives you some sense, as they say, let McCain be McCain. Of you know,
yeah,
I mean,
that's
McCain
right.
was quite good.
Yeah,
was,
I mean, the guy is
self-deprecating humor. It was great. It was
yeah,
terrific.
The guy
but I thought Obama
Bozo.
Was just so winningly.
Yeah.
present
yeah,
in his person at that event. He looked like the next president of the United States.
He is presidential. But McCain said when he was praising Obama, and it was very nice praise for Obama,
yeah,
he said, among other things, you know, kind of who'd have thunk it, you know, here we are, potentially first African-American president of the United States. And, you know, that isn't that a great thing? And I thought it was interesting that it was not something that Obama would have said, you know, is inclined to say about his about himself. And I wasn't sure whether McCain was, whether there wasn't some undertone of saying it to remind listeners of something that Obama maybe likes to get them to forget. But here's a question for you. That, and
I think that's ungenerous to McCain, but it might be true.
Maybe. I don't mean to be. I thought he was, you know, the guy, you know, it was a reminder that McCain is a very skilled guy and in some ways a decent guy and not a bozo. I mean, he was really...
All right, you know, the flip side of lionizing Obama is demonizing McCain. Yeah, I'm against that, too.
Yeah, I've the worst, as I've said, I think the worst thing to be said about McCain is that he picked Palin. I'm sorry, but anyway, but what about, so we're talking about identity, and identity is a matter of choice, and as a, and it was very interesting that in the list of identity categories that you mentioned a few minutes back, you mentioned gender and race and, you know, region and class and that, and, you know, ethnicity, et cetera, and you didn't mention religion.
Yeah,
and I think, and I'm going to give
it. But it belongs on the list.
I think it doesn't belong on the list.
You think it does not?
Yeah, I think religion is much deeper, much more important, and fundamentally different than other kinds of identity categories. And part of the reason for that, let me spin out a story. I know we're kind of out of time.
Yeah, but, we're past an hour now.
Yeah, but is. This is a real story about that I think brings out the issues about religion as a, you know, as a matter of choice or not voluntary, not voluntary. This is a real story from the history of American history and from a very important Supreme Court case in the early 1960s. So there's a Seventh-day Adventist in South Carolina. Her name is Adele Sherbert. She works in a textile factory. The economy is heating up. This is the early 1960s. South Carolina still has a textile industry. She works there, and they go from a five-day-a-week schedule to a six-day-a-week schedule. Six-day-a-week schedule, she can't work on Saturdays.
Yeah.
So she loses the job. She probably quits, or she says, I can't work. They say, okay, you're fired.
Yeah.
And she files for unemployment insurance. And the South Carolina unemployment insurance system says, you can't get unemployment insurance. You are voluntarily unemployed.
Oh, I see.
And she says, I'm not voluntarily unemployed. I can't work on Saturdays. What do you mean you can't work on Saturdays? I have an obligation not to. I didn't pick Saturday as the day of Sabbath. God picked it a long time before I was born. And the Supreme Court decided on her behalf. They said that requiring her... denying her unemployment benefits because she couldn't work on Saturdays on account of her fundamental religious obligations was equivalent to fining her for being a Seventh-day Adventist. And, of course, you can't fine her for doing that. You can't deny her unemployment benefits.
What year was this case, Josh?
I believe it was decided in 1962, 63, okay. Sherbert v. Verner. And I think the Supreme Court had it exactly right.
Okay.
That religion is not just another element of people's identity. It's not experienced by the religious adherent as a voluntarily undertaken identity category. It's experienced as deeper than that, as more fundamental, and as a matter of obligation, not as a matter of choice. And I think in a community of equals, showing respect to people requires taking that self-perception very seriously. And I think that distinguishes religion. It's what makes it more, you know, wonderful in human experience because it's something that really lifts people out of themselves. And it also is, I think, something that makes it more dangerous.
Okay, now let me...
Yeah.
I don't want to argue with your basic thrust, but I want to just put another consideration on the table.
Yeah.
When the religion that we're talking about is the expression of personal conviction, arrived at through willful election, we have one thing. When a person is a child born into a religious community and inculcated with those traditions, not by choice but by inheritance, they may yet reach the age of maturity and may in some sense affirm this inheritance of their own accord.
Right.
But are they not akin to someone who inherits an ethnic or nationalistic or racial identity? And won't there be cases in between? And I'm not just talking about the paternalism problem, the problem that parents may not want to get medical treatment for their children because they are Christian Scientists. And then we have to decide that the parent can't withhold the treatment from the child, and the child's in no position to make the choice for himself or herself. Although, of course, any given person of majority age could elect not to take treatment if it were a matter of their religious conviction, and we wouldn't feel that it would be right to compel them. But I'm not just talking about that problem. I'm talking about now the 21-year-old who affirms that I am a whatever it is. I am a Catholic. I am a Jew. I am a whatever.
Yeah.
And they're affirming that based on the fact that they've been channeled from the very first day into the tradition of, quote, our fathers, close quote.
Right.
And I don't know why the tradition of your fathers, with due respect, and not just your personal fathers,
no,
but
everyone's
fathers, deserves to necessarily
Trump
certain universalistic and humanistic claims that I might want to make about organization of society or whatever. I'm sort of part of the way there with you, but I think the argument needs to be fleshed out, especially in this area that I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, I think this is the place where, you know, one of the constitutional rubber meets the road on this in the United States is in the is in the education issue, and there is the interesting case about the old order Amish in Wisconsin. This is the case of Wisconsin v. Yoder, where the issue is it okay for the old order Amish to keep their high school age children out of school, being exempt from a general regulation that applies to everybody else that says high school age kids have to be in school, and if the parents don't have the kids in school, the parents are subject to fine and a penalty. And the problem there is that it's just absolutely at the core of the old order Amish set of convictions going back to the end of the 17th century when the old order Amish were formed, that they live apart.
Yeah.
They're living out the dictate of Romans.
Yeah.
You got to live apart, and that's their fundamental conviction. And the consideration on the other side is that, which goes exactly to the point that you're raising, is that there's a sense of responsibility on the part of the political community to make sure that if the old order Amish kid decides to stay old order Amish, it is a reflective decision made in full awareness that there are a range of other options that were available, and that's what education is supposed
precisely.
To do. Precisely. Yeah. And
this seems so fundamental to me, Josh. I mean, that's why I don't believe in an absolute right of communal self-determination.
Right.
People say that these old orders or tribes or whatever, their way of life must be preserved. It's not like I'm against its preservation or wouldn't credit that as a value in some circumstances, but it can't be absolute over and against the individuals who make up these communities.
That's right.
It
absolutely. But this is an introduction of a topic for further conversation and exploration, because I think everybody. Not everybody. Everybody who matters, namely you and me both in this conversation, we feel pulled in these two different directions. On the one hand, what I want to say, and I think you're agreeing with this some, is that there is something distinctive about religious convictions because of their peculiarly commanding sovereign importance in people's lives and decisions. On the other hand, there are principles and values that you can reasonably expect everybody in the political community to live up to, and it's not, and that religious convictions, as important as they are, are not a kind of, if I can put it this way, get out of jail free card. They're not a general ticket to exemption from the rules that apply to everybody else. And trying to find that ground where you can respect respect people who, as equals, who hold these convictions, and, you know, not treat them as something, you know, like with Adele Sherbert, treat them as just something, well, you decided to join the Seventh, you don't like working on Saturday, join another church. That's not an except. On the other hand, yeah.
Of course
yeah,
not.
It can't be that it's, you know, whatever your convictions are, they get you. They get you away from obeying the rules that apply to everybody else. And my point here is just that I think in thinking about this issue about religion, I don't think it helps that much to think of religion as just another identity category. There's something special about it, and to treat it as another identity category is, I think, to deny something that really is fundamental to the experience and sensibility of the religious believer, and that, I think, is a form of disrespect incompatible with the basic democratic ideal of treating people.
Okay, so here's one. I want to, since we're talking about this, I might as well put this on the table.
Yeah.
So people have been attacked for not believing in evolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I'm usually on the side of, well, my colleague Ken Miller, the biologist
yes.
here at Brown, who's
yeah.
gotten very famous going around the country and writing about this issue. No, I'm on the side of defending science, the Republican war on science. Well, I'm an enlistee fighting against the Republicans to
yeah.
that extent.
Yeah.
And George W. Bush, too, if he's a know-nothing in there, you know, saying the Book of Genesis is where I get my, you know, my geology from, well, you know, down with that. Darwin's a great man, okay?
Yeah. Right.
On the other hand, I can see somebody not believing in evolution. And in other words, my own personal life experience,
mm-hmm.
being in churches, knowing people who are believers, I can kind of see where they're coming from. They think the Bible is the word of God. I don't take that theological posture, and that's not my approach to textual interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen religious communities in which that's a very vibrant aspect of the faith. And I don't believe, therefore, that a public official, and here's where I'm going with this,
mm-hmm.
who's willing to answer that he has doubts about the scientific status of Darwin's theories or whether or not intelligent design is an argument that should be considered, that's disqualifying, that person has revealed themselves to be a Yahoo. And in fact, I think that position, even though I disagree with the judgment that politician might express, I think the position that this is a Yahoo, we don't want them with their finger on the button, keep them all the way away from any import, is bigotry of a certain kind. It's a kind of religious bigotry to discredit a person as a viable political figure because they ascribe to this particular corner of the edifice of conservative Protestant religiosity.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
I feel like I'm about to give an Obama-like answer, which is...
But I thought you would agree because you're talking about religion here.
Yeah, no, if I'm going to give an Obama-like answer, I have to begin by saying, look...
is it above your pay grade? Is that what you're
saying? That's above my pay grade, Glenn.
There's nothing above a political philosopher's pay grade.
Yeah, no, I agree. I really mean is I think this is where sound bites don't help. I think it really depends a lot on what else the
okay.
You know, Sarah Palin was, you know, excuse the metaphor, but, you know, pissed all over. This is the point of reference that you had for expressing some questions about, intelligent design and evolution. And when she elaborated further, and I'm not sure what she would have said if she had gone still further, but when I heard her elaborate further, what she said is, you know, in science class, you teach the theory of evolution, that one of her parents was a science teacher, and that her point was, you know, not about what you do in a science class. Now, if somebody said that you should teach the controversy in a science class about intelligent design and evolution. I'd say I don't agree with that because I think there isn't a scientific controversy. I don't think there is, you know, that there. But I think if somebody
said, talking about what should be taught in the classroom, by the way.
Right, but if you know, if somebody says, well, as your colleague Ken Miller says, I mean, he's a believing Catholic, that there is no tension between, and this is the Catholic Church position, that there is no tension between the theory of evolution and appreciation of science generally and religious conviction. I think it's completely. I think it's awful to say to be dismissive of that, or because you're not denying the theory of not denying evolution. That's why I think this is one of these cases where a lot depends on what else the person says. But you know, beyond you know, I've got my questions, I've got my I've got my doubts about it.
Yeah. Well. Okay. Let's call it quits because we're into an hour and 15 minutes now.
Okay. It's very good to talk to you and to be
as always.
Many things to be continued. Okay.
We'll catch up.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.